Once more into the breach, dear friend. Let's close the wall up with our English dead. Good morning again, and welcome to a second hour of the Personal Wealth Coach. I have a caller on 773-1400 who's been waiting patiently, so caller, you're on the air. Go ahead. Well, not so patiently. If you'd like to be on the air, the number in here is 254-773-1400. All right, so we were talking about the drug care, about prescription benefits, Medicare Part D, how to bring down the cost of pharmaceutical products. In order to really understand this, let's take a couple of steps back, because there's a lot of kind of surface-level conversation, soundbite-type conversation going on here. How is it that drug prices are priced? There's a market for it, but we're not part of that market. When you show up at the pharmacy, you cannot negotiate for your price. But negotiations take place. Okay, so how many middlemen are there? How many people in the middle between a pharmaceutical company and the end customer, a customer being a patient, are there? Well, from the pharmaceutical perspective, it's different than from the patient perspective. So from your perspective as a patient, you go to your doctor, the doctor writes a prescription. That's number one, middleman. Well, that middleman or middlewoman isn't getting a cut. There's some laws against doctors getting paid for the prescriptions that they write. Okay, so number one. Then you show up at the pharmacy. Usually there's some insurance involved. If it's Medicare, then it's Medicare. If it's some other insurance program, that's there too. The insurance company negotiates with each pharmacy company. So if you're talking about a local grocery store or a Walgreens or a CNC or CVS, that's not CNC, CVS, if you're talking about these as a whole, they've got big negotiating that goes on in the background. Every one of those insurance companies negotiates with most of those different pharmaceutical chains. And there's some pretty intense negotiations. The negotiations are, how much of our business are we going to try to push through your pharmacy chain? What benefit do we get? How much lower prices are we going to get? Then from the pharmaceutical chain's perspective, they've got to negotiate with, one, the insurance company on who's going to pay them and what price they will pay. But they also have to work on a separate market. And it's like what the stock market was early on in the stock market days. Only there's telephones involved and computers. If we're talking about, for instance, we'll use a relatively simple one, insulin. Insulin's vital if you've got type 1 diabetes. Some people with type 2 diabetes, it's also a requirement. Insulin is one of those things that we have known how to do for a very long time. The first patent on insulin and how to use it to save the lives of diabetics was released for public use by the people that developed it. So keep that in mind. And I think it was Eli Lilly. So I've got to make sure that's right. I believe it was Eli Lilly. They came up with the patent. They released it to the public. They said, anybody can do this. We're not going to try to make a big profit on this. This is a life-saving drug. Since then, a lot of changes have occurred. It was originally animal-derived insulin, and animal-derived insulin can have some allergic reactions when somebody injects it into their body. So over the years, two big companies now produce insulin. It's a completely new way of doing insulin, a new being relative. It's compared to the early 20th century. It's genetic-based. It's human insulin. One's created by a kind of yeast, and one's created by a kind of E. coli. These the bacteria and the yeast produce the chemicals, and then when they're combined, it is genetically perfect human DNA. It comes out as human insulin. People say, whoa, wait a minute. And this was developed decades ago. This is, you know, people talk about genetic modifications in their corn. Well, this is human DNA that was derived from very tiny little creatures. All right. there's the patents on those two production types have expired. There's no patent on it, which means normally that's when a generic company would step up and say, okay, I'm going to make this at cost or just above cost to make a little bit of profit. The problem is that this particular type of production has a very large front-end cost to get the little creatures to produce the right chemical. Takes a very, very controlled environment, and to do this on any large scale takes an extremely controlled environment. It's very expensive. But we have older forms of insulin that work. So in the United States, those older forms of insulin are not available at the pharmacy. Now, why is that? Well, because they're not quite as safe as the human genetic insulin. If you take an animal-derived insulin and you have an allergic reaction and somebody dies or goes blind or whatever may happen there, what is the American reaction to that kind of thing from a pharmaceutical company? I'll wait for it. Call a lawyer. Okay. There is a massive liability to the pharmaceutical company, to the pharmacy chain, to the insurance company, and to the doctor that writes the prescription. Even if the allergic reaction only happens in a fraction of 1% of the people, there's a massive liability there. In Texas, we have caps on punitive damages, but not on actual medical damages. So if this allergic reaction leads to the use of very expensive medicines and long stays in a hospital that the pharmaceutical company is now on the hook for because they still sold it. So number one problem there is that older drugs that have a newer replacement that are slightly safer go off the market. They still use those older insulins in Canada. They still use it in much of Europe and most of the rest of the world. They just kind of shrug their shoulders to the off chance that somebody's going to have an allergic reaction. Well, we need to look at that. We need to say, is it worth getting the huge payout to keep everybody else's prices high? So that's one issue. Second issue, those new insulins, when they come from two major companies, these two major companies are in neck and neck competition. They may lower the prices to try to beat each other out. They may raise the prices when they see a weakness on their other side. They're not the ones that set the price. A lot of times when, now this is one of those strange things about pharmaceutical production, you don't make the same amount of insulin every week because the creatures that make it don't do as well sometimes. You got to do quality testing. It's not like making a car. You got to make sure that the production of these organisms is online, is the right level of quality. So some weeks you have more and some weeks you have less. The pharmaceutical industry as a whole, the pharmacy companies that sell you the medicine directly, go to a secondary marketplace. Because sometimes they go to one of the companies and they don't have it on hand. Well, there's very much like the ticket scalping industry going on here. There are companies that go up and buy on surplus days. If Novo Nordisk or Eli Lilly are creating insulin and they make a little too much one week, and the pharmacy companies out there are purchasing the insulin, they didn't buy it all up. The price drops on that insulin, and another company swoops in and buys it because they know maybe next week they're not going to make enough, and somebody's going to come to me to buy it. That's a problem, except that, is it a problem? It's kind of free market. The real problem then comes in where Medicare isn't negotiating with those people, with Eli Lilly, or with Novo Nordisk, or with the CVS, or with Walgreens. And we've got a caller on 773-1400. Caller, you are on the air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yes, I might have missed part of your show. Explain again how they make insulin. Did I miss that?
You may have. They make insulin out of, there's a type of yeast one company uses, and another company uses E. coli. It's created in two specific separate batches in each of these cases. So each yeast or E. coli, they have two separate batches in production. One type of E. coli makes one batch, the other E. coli makes the other batch, and with the yeast, it's the same thing. One type of yeast makes one batch, the other yeast the other. And then they combine them, and when they combine, all the pieces come together and loop together into genetically perfect human DNA. It's one of the modern miracles that we're kind of unaware of in the general public. Did that help?
Yeah, and how expensive is it? I mean, you know, insulin, I don't know. I've never had that problem. But is insulin cheap? Or is
no,
it,
it's not.
It's expensive? Or
it's expensive. It's expensive because the environment that those creatures have to live in, the yeast or the E. coli, has to be very precise to make the insulin at the right quality. So it's not like, I mean, it sounds like we're talking about, oh, this is new stuff. What's going on here? We've used bacteria and fungus to create things for a very long time. That's what beer is. It's what wine is. So to breed these creatures so that they produce an insulin, which they already did, by the way. All of them produce insulin. That's how vinegar is created and so on. They convert the sugar into glucose. They use insulin to then take the glucose and make something called ATP, which is how they procreate. The same thing that we do internal to our bodies. We just tweaked them, bred them enough to make them produce human genetics. There's only two companies making it. It's got a shelf life, a very limited shelf life. If you don't keep it at the right temperature range, now that temperature range is a lot wider than it used to be. It used to be you had to keep it refrigerated all the time. Now you have a limited time when you shouldn't have it refrigerated and so on. It is expensive, though, because if you think about the environment to create, for instance, a beer brewery, you've got these huge vats. And one of the cool things about the new microbreweries is that each time you drink the beer, it's a slightly different flavor. It's got this kind of different full bodiness, and it's got a kind of a mind of its own. If you go to if you've got a particular type of wine that you like, and they use exactly the same kind of grapes every year, the wine tastes different from one year to the next, having to do with the environment. You can't have that happening with insulin. It's got to be exact. So that's expensive. They've got to very carefully monitor that. It's part of the reason why we don't have generics popping up, because it costs a lot of money to work at that level.
So let me ask you a question.
Okay.
So you're saying they actually make two different kinds, or is it two different parts when you're talking about they put them together?
They're two different parts that come together to make one whole.
Okay. All right. And what's the process? What's the time limit on that?
That's a good question. It takes weeks for one batch to go through from begin to end. So
okay.
It's not like putting a car through a machine process to make a car. You can do, you know, 300 in a day or whatever. It's not like that at all, which is also part of the reason why on specific days, if a batch fails for whatever reason, that one vat was just 1 degree too hot or too cold at the wrong time, then you have a failed batch. So what you're not going to hear me say in this is that pharmacy companies or pharmaceutical companies should not make a profit. That's absurd. They should be making a profit. It should be a good profit. The profits that they're making right now are absurd. They should be making, and usually when I say absurd profits, I clap my hands and say, good job, guys, except that this is a touchy industry. You shouldn't be making such a huge profit off of the backs of people that absolutely have to buy your product. So where do we step in as a regulator there? If we have the government say, hey, you can't make more than X amount of profit, that's absurd. I would never say that. What I would say is that we need to work harder on other companies being able to produce more competition in these areas. How do we do that in a way that allows it to move forward? Yeah. Go ahead.
How do we get to competition?
Okay. One thing that's for certain is if the profits stay at the level that they are in the pharmaceutical companies, the market's going to provide the competition. That's how fracking got started with the oil industry. You know, when we got oil prices that were up above $100 a barrel, it was way too expensive to frack. Well, now that we've started fracking, we figured out ways to make it cheaper. And if you get enough competition, then you're going to make cheaper insulin. What we've got now is this miracle of modern technology that's about 25 years old. It's not modern technology anymore. We've got better technology today. But the people that are doing it, that know how to go through all the regulatory process to get the stuff up and running, it is a hard process. If you want a startup company, it shouldn't be in pharmaceuticals. If you've got a, you know, if you, I've just sold a huge amount of my other startup company, I've got this massive amount of money, I'm going to start a immediately profitable company. Pharmaceutical would not be it, because if you're producing anything that has to go through the FDA, it's going to take years, many, many years. This is part of the reason why I say, go ahead.
Are these American companies?
Most of them. Yeah. Novo Nordisk is not an American company, but Eli Lilly is. Novo Nordisk was founded by a guy that went and worked at Eli Lilly for a while and then went back to Europe and founded Novo Nordisk, which is kind of a talk about intellectual property theft. The intellectual property laws that we have today were developed with a lot of thought to that specific case. But we've got competition now, except that they're not competing like a normal competition. They're more saying, I'm not going to lower my prices if you don't lower your prices, only they're not directly saying that to each other, or they'd be in trouble for fixing prices. They're just kind of going about their business, and neither of them is dropping the prices drastically to put the other one out of business. It's not real competition. They're just saying, we only make enough for about half of the population, and you make enough for about half of the population, so our prices are going to be within dollars of each other. That's not real.
I have one question for you, and then I'll let you go.
All right.
When was the last president that actually had a balanced budget?
Okay. Bill Clinton.
Who was it?
Bill Clinton.
Bill Clinton. Okay.
Yeah. That was, I can go into some detail on that because it wasn't really Bill Clinton that did it. It isn't a president that would balance the budget because the president only gets to sign the budget, you know, if or not sign it. The Congress has to
do it. He usually presents it to them, doesn't he? I mean, he usually is the one that tries to get the budget done
right,
with the people who are in Congress.
Right, but the president has not had their own budget as the congressional budget ever. They are required to submit a budget recommendation. It has never been accepted by the Congress, ever. There's not a single time in history where Congress said, you're right, we should just vote yes on this. So just keep that in mind. We give the president a lot of credit that doesn't really go to the credit of the president, like the economy, the whether or not the budget is balanced. Bill Clinton balanced the budget, except he didn't. It was Newt Gingrich's Congress. And it had a lot to do with the Resolution Trust Company, which during the savings and loan crisis bought up a really large amount of troubled assets, properties that were nobody wanted to buy, and then sold them for a huge profit to the government during the Clinton administration. Newt Gingrich was there. He just passed the Balanced Budget Act.
93 or 94, somewhere in that area?
Somewhere in that area, early 90s, yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call.
You bet.
What I would like to see out of this is the president going to Congress and giving some leadership to Congress. One of my biggest complaints about the last administration, about President Obama's administration, is that he wasn't leading Congress. He didn't tell them, here's my plan, and he didn't gather a group of people in Congress and bring them to the White House and say, let's coordinate this. I want it to come out the right way. I mean, the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, is a direct representation of that. What he debated on the in the debates with Hillary Clinton is not what came into law. What came into law is what Congress put together, and they said to the president, sign it or else. Even though it was the president getting elected that gave them the opportunity to do that. We come forward to today, the recent tax cuts or changes, and the president is the reason why Congress had the ability to do it. But the tax cuts look nothing like what were the campaign promises, because the campaign, no matter what they promise, they cannot change the law. Congress has to change the law. So what we have is not a three-tier tax system, not going back to the overhaul that was equivalent to what happened in 1982 by Ronald Reagan. When we're talking about the tax code today, we've got seven brackets just for income, and that doesn't get into any of the...
to your next Fox News 3030.
Hold on just a moment. Fox News is trying to talk over me. That doesn't go into any of the other brackets for commodities, for oil, gas, gold, wheat, corn, estate taxes. There are brackets for everything. And if you think about how money comes out of a business, there's more brackets today than there were last year. Now, it's better for the business because it's lower taxes, but it's also worse for the business because it's more complicated to figure out how you're going to get paid. And you may have some big expenses to change. When your business decisions are not about your business, but how to best take advantage of the tax situation, you're not spending your time doing the things in business that make you money. That's a problem. It's a major problem. Congress has to get out of the habit of passing laws to pass laws. The deep state concept that I talked about last hour, where Congress delegates a huge amount of their legislative authority to the executive branch to follow up on things. Dodd-Frank did it. Pension Protection Act of 2006 did it to say, hey, Labor Department, SEC, come up with a fiduciary standard. We'll go through all the testing and then we'll put that as a rule. Well, the law says already that you've got to act as a fiduciary when giving advice on a retirement product. But the rules to back up the law do not exist at this point. So, in effect, because the rules don't exist, the government is breaking its own law and making lawbreakers of a large number of people that are trying to do their best. So there's some major issues there. A lawbreaker that isn't being prosecuted because there's no way to prosecute it because the rules weren't correctly implemented by the government. None of this is pre-planned. We've got a short-sighted House of Representatives. When they make a law, they're not revoking laws when they make the laws. If they, you know, the tax code that would just passed may have been considered an overhaul, but it didn't get rid of the previous tax code at all. It's another layer on top of the previous tax code that if you read the previous tax code, it's not valid anymore. Only some of it is, because you have to read the next part of the tax code to figure out which parts of the previous tax code got lined out. They didn't go back and line out the previous tax code, the new version of the code on top of the code. You see what I'm saying? It's complicated. It's messy. We have kind of the nightmare of George Orwell going on, where the system has gotten so convoluted, there's no simplification anywhere. When we're talking about pharmacy, medical, the government is so involved in that. There are ties all the way across it. We have a horribly warped socialist form of pharmaceutical pay and medical pay, where the end customer has no negotiation potential. If you show up at the emergency room, you're going to get treatment because it's an emergency. You show up, you get your treatment, at the time of the treatment, nobody involved in the treatment knows what it's going to cost. The doctor doesn't know. The nurse doesn't know. The x-ray technician doesn't know. The ambulance driver doesn't know. The patient doesn't know. The hospital doesn't know. They send a bill onto your insurance company. The insurance company looks at the bill and pays some of it and pays some and doesn't pay some of it. Well, which part do they pay? Well, it depends on the code that's put on there. If it's miscoded, there's a problem. There is such a convoluted nature to this, it can only be created by the government. It's very much like the tax code. If you make a certain amount of money and you own a business and you take your taxes to be done, it's a slightly complicated situation because you own a business. Your taxes arguably can never be done correctly. Because if you take them, this is something that happens every year, it's all in the news, where you take the same tax prep stuff to the tax preparers and you do 12 different companies and you get 12 different answers. When you go to the hospital for the same treatment two times in a row, it's unless it's just automated, it's pretty unlikely that you're going to get the same bill for both procedures. Because nobody knows. You can miscode it or code it appropriately because it could be four different codes. We've got some problems that we have to deal with on the bureaucracy side. And the bureaucracy side comes because we have a convoluted system that's being enforced. Alcohol, tobacco, it's sort of the same thing. The government gets involved and says distributors have to be, and alcohol distributors have to be different from the people that are the overall major industry, the ones that create the thing. And the people that sell it may not be allowed to distribute or create except in certain cases. And that's at the state level, everywhere. Well, the state level is where insurance is regulated. And no matter how much the federal government wants to change the prices of prescription drugs, unless we figure out how to get all the states involved or make a constitutional amendment to regulate insurance companies better, then we're only ever going to have duct tape and Band-Aids. And duct tape's pretty amazing, and I don't have a problem with Band-Aids. They sure help. But when the entire system is duct tape and Band-Aids, that's not what you want. And that's what we have right now. So how do we fix it? Well, the fact that we're talking about it is nice. The fact that the best solution we've got to date was the Affordable Care Act is a shame. Because the Affordable Care Act had some really good pieces in it. I know there's people gasping out there, what? You said Obamacare was good. There are parts of it that are amazing, that were written by Ronald Reagan. There's another shock for you. Why do we call it Obamacare if Ronald Reagan wrote a big chunk of it? Well, because he signed it, I guess. I don't know. The Republicans are the one that assigned his name to it. Ronald Reagan said, hey, insurance companies should be able to have coverage on people up to their age 25. Well, that's part of the Affordable Care Act. The fact that a college kid leaving the house or an 18-year-old kid going off to do a trade somewhere didn't get covered under their parents' plan meant that the vast majority of kids that age, kids being loose, they're adults, didn't have coverage, which raised the cost of insurance for everyone because that's the healthiest group of people. So when the Affordable Care Act was passed, the first 5 years of it, we saw a drop and a flattening. First a drop and then a flattening of insurance premium costs. We did not see a drop in the cost of medical care. So we're dealing with two different subjects there. When you're talking about drugs, prescriptions, the way to make that less expensive is to negotiate better prices. If the largest portion that can negotiate isn't allowed to, that's Medicare, then don't expect the prices to come down. You know, imagine yourself as a business owner. You've just created something that nobody else can create on the planet. You've just made something that took huge amounts of your time and research to make. And you want to pay yourself back for it, plus some, so that you can make a nice living. And you go to the negotiating table with someone, and you sit down, and you rub your hands together, and you say, all right, I know what I want to get for this drug. And you sit down, and you say, this is the amount I want. And the other side says, okay. Well, that makes you smile. And the next time around, you show up and you say, I'm going to raise that a little bit and see if they object. And you raise it a little bit and they don't object. They're willing to pay it. In a free market system, a fair price is what people are willing to pay. Except this isn't a free market system. This is a system where the negotiator has his mouth duct taped shut and has to only nod yes. That's a problem. The only way to fix that problem cannot be done at the executive level. The president doesn't have the authority to say to Medicare, you need to start negotiating because there's a law. The law has words written in it. Those words clearly say Medicare is not allowed to negotiate. No matter what the president says, the law was passed by Congress and signed by a president. It was passed by a Republican Congress and a Republican president. The Affordable Care Act was passed by a Democrat Congress and a Democrat president. Anytime you have solidity in the power base, you make these broad sweeping things that are really hard to fix later. When there's breakage in them, it's really hard to get it fixed. The Affordable Care Act, nobody's talking about how do we fix the Affordable Care Act. There's one side that says there's no way to fix it, repeal it. The other side says there's nothing wrong with it. Why would you fix it? It's amazing. It smells like unicorns and cupcakes. Neither of those sides are true. So how do we fix it? We have to fix it by recognizing the reality of the situation and getting some foresight, saying, how do we build the system that we want? First off, let's get the experts involved. How do we build a system that doesn't take away the profits from the people that are creating the stuff? They've got to get paid. That doesn't cut the pay of doctors. We don't have enough of them. That doesn't mess up the ability for people to live because they can't afford the drug. Should the government even be involved? And some people would say no. Well, wait a minute. If the government's not involved, how do we know that the drug that you're taking is the right drug? How do we know it's not going to kill you? The government's got to be involved in there. Well, now we got to define how much involvement the government needs to be. If the government needs to only be involved up to the point where it's saying there needs to be open and free negotiations across the board, that makes sense. But when the government says, I'm the biggest buyer of this stuff and I'm not going to negotiate, that puts handcuffs on the negotiating for every other insurance company out there. They cannot come to that same table after the big giant in the room with the duct tape on his mouth is nodding and said, yeah, I'll pay that, and say, well, we're only going to pay half that. Well, then we won't sell to you. We'll just keep selling more to the big giant in the room with the duct tape on his mouth. We got to fix it, and that's up to Congress. But the only way Congress can fix it is if the Republicans and the Democrats can forget for a moment the R in the D after their name and remember the American part. Remember the part that says, we're both trying to get cheaper drugs. We're both trying to get to a place where regulation occurs, people aren't dying needlessly because the drugs are bad. People who have paid into Medicare their whole lives are still getting a benefit. But also a benefit that doesn't cripple the budget, because we're talking about Medicare's budget is ballooning. We're talking about insurance costs going through the roof. We're also talking about the major insurance companies having record profits. How can the insurance companies get record profits off of this sort of regulated environment? Well, because that's what their job is. That's why they exist, is to make profits. They're not a nonprofit business. We don't want them to be. What we do want is good competition. When the government removes competition and then says anybody can set the price anywhere they want, they are the monopoly. They are setting the prices for everybody, because the pharmaceutical companies could make a profit. They could change how they're creating things to make a profit if they needed to. This is similar to my conversation about solar power. we're not developing better practical application of solar of photovoltaics because there's huge subsidies from the government. The government says this stuff is renewable, it's great, we should be promoting it. Well, as long as a solar panel company can make a profit developing old technology and selling it to the public, why should they change? If you're making a good profit doing something, why should you completely change your entire lineup and bring in a new technology, a huge amount of money invested in that, to bring something new to the table, which you're going to get about the same price for? Why would you do that? Well, you wouldn't. Same thing's going on here. Until the government steps back and allows competition to be competition, allows the market to determine when we go to solar power and how we buy our prescriptions, then we're not going to get the market reaction to overprices. We're not going to be able to, because generics cannot begin to compete in the insulin world. There are a lot of generic insulins, but they all produce animal insulin, and they're not for sale in the United States. Nor maybe should they? That's another question. I mean, should they be? It's going to have an allergic reaction to a small percentage of people, but it might kill them. When you look at the other prescription drugs out there that also might kill them that are being sold in the United States, well, maybe if we do that, I mean, we go from $200 or $300 a vial, a very small vial for insulin, to $20 a vial. That's the actual profitable price of the generic insulin. Or less. Sometimes it's $10 a vial. And that is profitable. When we talk about the newest technology and the safest technology, we got to recognize that when we make a decision to say everybody's got to have airbags in their car or everybody's got to have a car that has seatbelts in it, that's going to affect the price of the car because those airbags have to be installed and the seatbelts have to be installed. That comes from somewhere. It's going to make the price go up. When the price goes up, the consumer is going to pay for it. If we are okay with that, and I am, by the way, for airbags and for seatbelts, I think it should be more market-driven, though. And in the case of cars, it is. The government doesn't tell a car manufacturer right now that it's got to have airbag surrounding everybody. There are some regulations that are being made. We got to get the free market back to being the free market, or what we're seeing with the pharmaceutical drug companies, what we're seeing with taxes, and now what we're seeing with trade, with quotas and tariffs. We're going to have such a convoluted system that it will stunt the growth of our economy. We're not there yet. We can fix this still. But we got to get on the boat of saying, forget about the R or the D. Forget about re-election. What's best? And if you trust that your constituents are going to hear you when you say that, you trust that the American public is actually semi-intelligent, and they know that what you're trying to do isn't about the R or the D. It's about what's best for the economy or what's best for the American public in general or their constituents in particular. Yeah, and that's got to balance too. Then I think the American public is going to respect that. It's going to take a different form of conversation between politicians and the constituents, though. And it's going to take people being willing to keep people to their promises. If somebody says, elect me for term limits, and they're there for their fifth time around, and they said they were going to be there for two, well, somebody should say something about it. It should be a normal thing to come out and say, hey, remember when you said that? What happened? Why are you doing this? And it may be a good reason. If it's a good reason, then you should keep an open mind. But you did promise. All right, I got to play some commercials. I'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. I appreciate all of you people for listening. If you would like to call in here, I'm Jake McClure. This is the Personal Wealth Coach. The phone number is 254-773-1400, and I'll be back on the other side. And I'm back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. If you would like to call in, the phone number here is 254-773-1400. This is Jake McClure. I wanted to address something We just heard a political advertisement on here. I'm not going to go into who it was or what it's about, except that one of the major pieces of it was property tax reform. Let me address that a little bit, because there's a Republican-Democrat divide here that I find ludicrous, because they're ignoring the biggest part of this, the ridiculousness of how we do property taxes, period. Always. We always have. I had a house that I remodeled and refurbished that was built in the 1880s in Central Texas. That's a saga in itself. It's a huge deal. It had no, it was a very nice Victorian home, all wood, longleaf pine, beautiful. When it was done, it was absolutely gorgeous. There were no closets in the entire house. Well, maybe they just hadn't invented closets yet. Nope, that's not it. Property taxes at the time were not based on the value of your property. They paid for schools based on the number of closets in your house. So the closets were never built into this house. They used wardrobes instead. This is how taxes change how we live. We move forward. We're talking about property tax reform. The governor says we need to reform taxes. You know, we got to put a limit on how much they can lift taxes. Well, we've done that. Every legislative session in the past two decades has had property tax reform as part of the thing that they've been talking about. It's been one of the things that has been acted on multiple times since then. Let's discuss the ludicrousness of it. If you look at a company like Zillow or Realtor.com or Trulia, and you find your house, or maybe you just bought your house, maybe you just sold your house, you look at the value that the market places on that house, and you'll be looking at it, you say, hey, that's pretty good. That's a lot better than it was 10 years ago. That makes me really happy. Then you look at the county appraisal for your house. We all know this. The county appraisal is going to be way lower than the market value. Well, then why is it called an appraisal? It shouldn't be called an appraisal. It's not an appraisal. It's just a random number. That's pretty ridiculous that we say your property tax is based on the value of your property, but not really. We're going to make another number up. That number can go up by a certain percentage capped every year, and only that much so that you can make budgets. When it does go up by that much, everybody complains. I complain, you complain, we all complain. Let's talk about how ludicrous that is. They just raised the value of my house. Well, is it worth that? No, it's worth a lot less. It's worth a lot more than what they raised it to. Okay. So we're paying more in taxes. That's a sad thing for you. It's a good thing for the schools, I guess. How do we do this right? How do we do it in a way that isn't going to pinch people who are on a fixed income and their property value goes up? Well, we've already said there's a regulation out there, there's a law out there that if you're above a certain age, you can lock in your property tax values. It can't go up. It's flat forever because you're not going to have any more kids. So you'll pay something for schools, but not as much as everybody else when taxes go up. Yours won't go up. It'll be stay. And if you're disabled, that's the same for you. If you've got a homestead on the property, we're going to look at it differently than if you've just got normal, you know, kind of land out there or a business or something. We're getting into complicated messiness again. School's got to be paid for. Where's the negotiation? Again, how do we pay for schools appropriately? How do we change the technology in the schools to be appropriate for the education of a modern era? How do we avoid budget issues when people's taxes go up in a moment? They're up. We've got to find a better way of collecting taxes that's not so restrictive. When I hear Republicans attacking Republicans, by the way, and that's what the political ad was, it makes me a little sick. Because right now, the only change that we're going to get in the system right now is if Republicans work together, because there's not enough Democrats. So if there's not enough Democrats around and the Republicans are fighting each other over stuff, then we've got a two-party system again anyway, only now it's how conservative are you, how liberal are you as a Republican. And even then, what's said is vastly not true. When one candidate says about another one, he said at this particular open session that he's not going to support reform on the taxes. Come on. There's not anybody that would say that. If you twist words enough, that will happen. It's politics. And we're giving the politicians the ability to change how we live our lives. This is something we've had for a long time. It's a really messy system. It's still the best system out there. But it means that we've got to get together outside of politics, Democrats, Republicans, outside of politics, come up with a plan. We got to pay for schools. How are we going to do it? Let's come up with some new ideas. Let's have a think tank on this. Let's all sit down and say, how do we do this properly? How do we pay for schools that isn't going to require us every legislative session to come up with another reform to the tax code? If we're reforming our property taxes every time we have a legislative session, we've got a broken system. It shouldn't need that many tweaks. It should be something that works. And that's a problem, guys. We've got to figure this out in a way that isn't about, he doesn't even want to recognize the problem. Well, nobody wants to recognize that the system that we're using is antiquated, but it's something. How do we change this? It's not really reform. How do we make a new form that meets the same goals? And there's ways of doing it. It's happening all over the world. People are paying for schools. Let's look at all the ways that it's being done and come up with some ideas that are maybe a little bit different. Let's start trying it out. That's the way we move forward, not making ever increasingly complex rules that say how we undervalue houses in our property tax system. I mean, it really is silly. We've got this serious looks on our faces as we debate this system of, I hate seeing my property taxes go up every year. Well, we all do. But look at why it's going up. It's because your house is valued at $100,000 less than its actual value. And we still have to pay for the schools. I am not advocating for raising taxes. I am advocating for a system that doesn't include inherently in it the inability to look ahead and see what your budget's going to be next year. You never know how much they're going to raise the value of your property. You know they're going to raise it because the value of your property is a lot less than what it should be. So it's going to get raised. How much they raise it, well, I'm going to go and contest that. How do you rationally contest a raise in value of your property unless it's above the market rate? If you can get that much money or more for it, how do you contest it? And that's a problem because we do contest it, because we do say, hey, I don't want to pay this much more taxes, and you forgot about this particular exemption. I've got a homestead or whatever on there. Right now, it's a tug of war between the tax collector and us. We are the ones that make the tax law. We make the votes. Let's put together a system that works. How do we do that? Well, it's out there. We've just not changed anything except for reforming things that didn't work very well slightly by duct taping and band-aiding them together. We can do better. That's the thing that I think people should be talking about in the debate. We can do better than this. Our entire government bureaucracy at the local, state, and federal level can be done better. But it's not going to take one person coming in to do it. It's going to take everybody saying, hey, how do we do this better? We've got to meet these goals. How do we do it? That means we all have to get involved and stop getting caught up in the intricacies of whether or not one paragraph suggests that this broken system should be treated this way or that way. And that's where we are today. We're so much in the minutiae that we're missing the major portions are broken. And if we don't fix the major broken pieces, they're not going to get better no matter how much we change the minutia. So keeping that in mind, that's from an economics perspective, not a politician perspective. The reality is that I don't see that change happening unless a lot of people become aware of the ludicrous nature of how we're doing things at this level. I mean, if a business were run this way, it would go broke. And, you know, you look at the government, the federal government, the debt versus income ratio, nobody would invest in that company. And yet people are, and I am, you are, because we live in that company. That company is our country, and we can do better. So whether it's, I tend to think that we are the greatest country on the planet still. Let's stay there by fixing the systems that we are just kind of bumbling into making rather than planning ahead. And I'm about out of time. Thanks for listening. I've been ranting. I appreciate the time. If you'd like to call us off the air, we do give fiduciary investment advice to people of high net worth. The phone number locally is 254-947-1111 or toll-free 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can email me directly at jake@tpwc.com. You can email my dad, jeff@tpwc.com. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com. And until next week,
TM AM Temple Belton Killeen Fort Hood. Proud to broadcast to the largest military post in the free world. News Radio 1400 KTEM.